The folks of the Historic Bostons began envisioning this program a good long time ago. And in previous years, they've looked at the founding of Boston. How did this city on a hill begin? Its Puritan forebears, its connections to Boston, England, and to the nonconformist tradition. How did this place called Boston begin? That was always their concern. But they did a very brave thing, braver than I suspect they knew, because you are entering truly delicate and difficult territory, because you thought to yourselves, why don't we take the opportunity to take a week and think about the people that greeted them, the people that were already there. And so on Thursday night at the Boston Public Library, Feather on the Moon, Gil Solomon, the sachem of the Massasoosket tribe, was trying to tell us, as best he could, moving through a lot of pain. I don't think that those listening had any idea just how difficult this assignment was for him. For Feather in the Moon to get up and talk about their very different way of thinking about their history and history that binds us, all of us. The simple things he had to say to us. One thing I took away, I mean, I knew it before, but I felt it so emotionally that night, was he says, don't call us Indians. That was your navigational mistake. We call ourselves the people. The Canadians have it right, I think. They call them First People or First Nation. I like that. We use often here Native American, but again, American comes from an Italian navigator, so they can't win. So I'm going to use the word the people today. I like that. And he talked about the conception that they carry in their hearts, even in this modern technological digital age, a very different conception. We, in the white world, the world that they now have to deal with and navigate through, and have since 378 years ago, we tend to think of history as a linear group of events, one thing after another. One thing causing another. He said, we don't think that way. He said, a native understanding of our place in the universe, there is no concept of linear time. Many native storytellers begin with the words, in a time before now. There is the present moment, but the past and what is to come actually are combined in one sacred circle, one hoop. One connection. If you catch a fish in the past, it's like catching the fish in the future. It is the events of human life and death and procreation and looking at the stars. All of this connects up to what will come to be someday. And it is all one motion. It is all one reality. They think of history in a totally different way than we do. He said, all time for us, it's the same. And then he said, and it was a cry from the heart, and was said with some pride, and it was said with, I think, legitimate anguish. We are still here. This sermon began for me some years ago when I was walking through the Harvard campus, and I saw a plaque I'd never noticed before. It was near the gate that leads right out into Harvard Square. And it described the fact that Harvard had originally been founded partially for the education of what they considered their Indian brothers. Six lived in this particular hall They became largely printers, including the first printing press in New England and in America. We don't even know their names. At first I thought, oh, I would like to write a book about them, but there's no information. We actually only know the names of one of them, John Sussman, who we'll hear a little bit later a little more about. Like so many, they have been swept away by history. And that little plaque reminded me of a story about our forebears that I simply didn't know. And when I heard Feather and the Moon talk about in the time before now, I thought to myself, this sermon is going to be, from my perspective, from our linear way of looking at life and history, in the time since then. And I know its limitations, and I speak from those limitations. But I'll speak as truthfully as I can, as Gil Salmon spoke as truthfully as he could. When we think of Thanksgiving and Massasoit, Squanto, all those wonderful stories from our childhood myth, we forget, and those of you who've read the recent bestseller by Nathaniel Philbrick, Mayflower, we forget that within one generation came the King Philip's War, where Massasoit's son met a comet, better known to us as King Philip, although that was not his name. It was, per capita, the bloodiest war in American history. So many colonists, or as they called us, the invaders, died. And the people themselves were virtually eradicated. By the end of the war, it is estimated that in 1600 there were 72,000 Native Americans living on these parts. By the end of the King Philip War, there were 400 Wampanoags left. That makes that cry of Feather of the Moon that we are still here so incredibly poignant. It's a story we don't really know. It's a story we don't really tell ourselves. But if we're truthful, it's really the story of the world as we know it. The tidal wave throughout history of more than just the Puritans happening to come to these shores. It is the story that even goes to your newspaper when tanks roll into Georgia. And the oldest story of all, because the Puritans who came here, encountering those that they call the Indians, they took as their story the Hebrew scriptures and how the Hebrews circled back into the Holy Land and took over the land from the people that lived there. And I don't know about you, but I suspect that that's a story 6,000 years on that's in the headlines. It still is. It's history. And it's also the heart of what it means to be human. This tidal wave throughout history of migration upon migration, which becomes conquest, which becomes, in the end, conversion, because history always drags in religion and faith into the mix, doesn't it? And that's part of what I'm going to talk about today, is how that happened here in the life of one man, a very good man, named John Eliot, called in history Apostle to the Indians. And what happens when you have these tidal waves of migration and conquest and conversion? You also come close to the edge and sometimes way over into cultural eradication. Sometimes in modern terms we call it ethnic cleansing. That's the way we call it in the Balkans. Rosemary referred to it in our prayer as genocide. All this is acutely uneasy and unpleasant and difficult, but if religion and faith cannot deal with what is uncomfortable in our hearts and soul and history, then religion isn't worth very much. And that's why we're here today. And that's why you all were pretty brave to take this on. Because it opened up doors we normally don't open and we normally want closed. Because it's very difficult when we hear the shining city on a hill, knowing that the American dream contains this too. And always has. And it's hard. It's really emotionally hard to think about it and to reflect on it and to think through, well, what is in fact the spiritual response? What are we supposed to do with this? This hard stuff. The state seal of Massachusetts has an Indian on it. And the Indian has a little quote coming out of his mouth. And does anyone here know what it says? Come over and help us. That was the ethos and self-understanding of the Puritans who came here. And if you will turn your eyes back to the four flags right there in the middle of the sanctuary, could one of you get up and the state flag is the white flag. Would you hold it out a little bit? Who stands in the middle of our state flag? A representative of the people. This is at the heart of the enterprise of being Massachusetts and American. And I would submit to you this morning, thank you, Ethan, I would submit to you this morning of just being human. The history we share is a tangled and at times a deeply tragic one. And then you mix in the missionary impulse. Now, in modern days, missionaries don't have very high reputations. Desmond Tutu is the Anglican bishop of Johannesburg, South Africa. When he was awarded the 1984 Nobel Prize, he said this. When the missionaries first came to Africa, they had the Bible and we had the land. And they said, let us pray. And we closed our eyes. And when we opened them, the tables had been turned, for we had the Bible and they had the land. But this is really deep and tricky stuff. Nietzsche, the philosopher, once said, only fighting in this world yields happiness on earth. Now think about that. The great German philosopher Nietzsche says, only fighting yields happiness on earth. Ernest Troeltsch said, contending national spirits unfold their highest spiritual powers. Great philosophers and sociologists and historians all combine and say this great conflicting tidal wave of history, of people moving and conquering and migrating over one another, somehow has a spiritual component. And that's where that missionary element comes in. Albert Schweitzer, when he went to get his doctor's degree in medicine and then went to Africa, said, I did not come here to civilize, but to heal. But for centuries upon centuries, and certainly this is true of the person I will speak of a little bit this morning, John Eliot, they came to civilize. And as they civilized, an odd thing happened. The people disappeared. They had to literally fight for their survival as a tribe and as families, even to retain their language. Someone at the library the other night asked Feather the Moon if he could speak a few words of his language for us all. And he said, I will not, because we have fought so hard to recover our language. I must treat it as sacred. And he's right. And there are generally two ways of dealing with migration, conquest, destruction. We can ignore it, and that's our preferred method. Or we can sometimes romanticize it and to say, oh, I feel guilty, I apologize, I feel really bad about it. Let's romanticize it. Neither, I would suggest this morning, is the proper way to go. Although we certainly are going to circle back into the people's spirituality, because in fact they do offer us a way to come home to each other, in a way that is honest, but not sentimental. I think what we need to do is to acknowledge two things. One is that apology is important. We have done so in the case of this congregation. There in the back is the words of Ann Hutchinson, who we exiled. We actually, a couple years ago, actually went through a formal process of an apology and to bring her back into the life of our congregation and its history. That was necessary and important to do. But the main thing, beyond apology, is to learn to tell the story true and straight and right, as honestly as we possibly can, as truthfully as we can, because I really do believe it's true that the truth shall set you free. And if not free, at least whole. Because we have been so separated from one another, our histories and our different conceptions of history, and this tragedy has separated us so brutally from one another. And in the best history, you find the best spirituality. There is no such thing as cheap grace. It is hard-earned and honestly won. John Eliot is an interesting man to think about. He came here 1 year after Boston had been founded. For more than 6 months, he actually was a member of this congregation, and in John Wilson's absence in England, he actually served this congregation, and they wanted him to stay, this bright young man. And he said, no, the people in Roxbury need and want me, and for the next 40 years, he preached on Meeting House Hill, helped found the Roxbury Latin School. He did a lot of good work. Every Sunday morning, he preached to his people. But he did something else. He had a virtually full-time job in the creation of 14 what they call praying towns. He had an idea that somehow that the people who had founded the Mass Bay had abandoned their actual intention, which had been to civilize those that they'd found here. And he realized we were doing nothing, they were doing nothing, and that the peoples were moving farther and farther apart. He decided that he would do his best to create common ground, commonality. He would learn their language. He would translate over 10 years Algonquin into the Bible. It was a fantastic achievement. One that MIT linguists still look at today as one of the singular achievements in modern intellectual history. And John Eliot was a good man. He loved the people he worked with. He honestly did. He wanted to convert them. He wanted to civilize them. Most of all, he said, without civility, there can be no religion. Now, can you imagine what people around him thought in hearing this? Because they did not see this outreach as useful and necessary. They thought it was hopeless. But he knew that something had to be done. Something good could be done. We don't know. We don't actually know what he said. We don't have transcriptions. But oddly enough, someone went with him and wrote down the questions that he received. And can you imagine being surrounded by the people, and John Eliot is preaching Calvinist theology and scaring them out of their wits? We know by transcription what were the questions that they asked John Eliot. They are good questions, and Unitarian Universalists still ask them today. What is the kingdom of heaven? How do we believe in what we cannot see? Does the white God hear our prayers? Why has no man ever told us this before? No white man. When you say it is our salvation and we will go to the devil. Where is Jesus now? Why didn't God kill the devil? Good question. What is salvation? Why does God punish us in hell forever? Roger Williams, Indian friend Wequash, wrote down once his reaction to hearing Puritan Calvinist theology. He wrote, and please get past the pigeon quality of this, because to me it strikes a chilling chord in my heart. Me so big, naughty heart, me heart all stone. My heart all stone. Eliot did the best he could do to get these two peoples to connect, to understand, to base their common life on civility. But then the King Philip's War began. And in that process, it didn't matter whether you were one of the called praying Indians in the 14 towns that John Eliot had established for the people, or whether you were in open rebellion against the invaders. It didn't matter in the end, because one way or another you died, and more than 1,000 were sold into slavery to Bermuda. This, too, is part of our history. And King Philip's head was placed on a pole for 25 years at Plymouth Plantation. And everything that John Eliot had worked for had been swept away in the destruction. He did not give up. He still had a good heart and a full heart. And he kept working until the day he died at age 86. But something of what he went through and something of what he experienced at some level would say to us today, oh, it's hopeless. But that is not actually the experience of John Eliot, and it's not, in the end, the truth of our situation. Migration, conquest, and the missionary impulse, these things are powerful and true, and they tangle us in every which way imaginable. But in the people's spirituality, they believed in this great hoop. They believed in this deep connection between the past and what is yet to come, and that it is all one. They called it the sacred circle, or the hoop. They believed that everyday life, in its simplicity and connection to the movements and energies of the earth and its balance, that everyday life in men and women and children could connect to these energies. One person, as they looked at the theology of the Northeast woodland folk, described it as to receive many invitations to stay alert, to walk lively, not to take anything for granted, and to look on the whole world is always on the verge of offering new wonders of beauty. John Eliot was a good man and dedicated and loving for his age and remarkable for his keen acceptance and understanding. No one's heart was more broken than he. But his tragedy and ours is that even in his most loving work, there was a seed of that tide of history that must be overcome. And I believe in that spirituality of the time before now, the feather in the moon shared with us the other night, and his expression that we're still here, is a wonderful indication that there is a hope that overarches even the tragedy, and the tragedy is real enough, and it always has been. People are everywhere really the same. And the acts of the past are to be found in the acts of the future before us now. There, it has always been so. The Great Spirit wills it so. And this for them is not superstition, and it is most certainly not myth. It is reality.